Thank you.
Good morning.
May
it please the court, my name is Mark Ledlove, and I represent the appellants in this case. My clients are five couples who bought custom homes in a subdivision known as the Arbors at Sugar Creek. They purchased their residence through the developer of that subdivision, Evolution Developments, prior to the end of 2009. Each of their homes is custom, with a look that's quite distinctive to other houses in St. Louis, although all of them share similar characteristics to each other. Photographs of those houses, and I think this is important for the court to be aware of and have a good chance to look at those, photographs of those homes are page A71 through A75 of the appendix. The home that we believe does not comply, or the house that we believe does not comply with the restrictions in this case, is at page A76 of the appendix, and that's while it's in construction. The homes that my client's owners have been described as being in prairie style, using stucco and stone, and with roof lines that are atypical to many of the houses in St. Louis. And various shapes and neutral colors are associated with those houses. Now, to protect their interest and their substantial investment in those houses, my clients relied on declarations of restrictions and covenants that Evolution Developments had drafted and recorded prior to the subdivision being constructed.
Now, was Jefferson Bank, the appellee, were they the mortgage company at that time? At the time, did they see those restrictions and know about those restrictions when they gave the loan to Evolution?
Absolutely, Your Honor. In fact, the evidence in the record is clear that Jefferson Bank and Trust subrogated its interest to that to those declaration of restrictions and covenants. They not only knew, but they affirmatively signed off and approved that those declarations and restrictions controlled the subdivision.
What about the bank's argument that it just said those things should be considered and not that it didn't require specific materials to be used?
Well, Your Honor, when you get down the road to the question of how the board, if it was properly constituted, and if that homeowners association was the proper homeowners association, indeed, that's exactly what the Declaration of Covenant says. But you had to have a fair board and the correct board making that determination. Our argument is that we did not. We had a tainted board of unqualified board members, those board members being a board that was stocked by the bank because they believed they could take over this and start, first of all, they could start a new homeowners association, which they did, which we contend that they could not, and that was not the proper homeowners association, that they then stocked that homeowners association with its own executives that rubber-stamped plans. In fact, not only did it rubber-stamp plans.
Concerning the procedure in which the new association and the new leadership was formulated that was in violation of any of the rules set out in the agreement itself?
Well, originally, yes, Your Honor, because the original covenants...
The original covenant had a provision to amend, right?
Correct.
It had a way to amend, and it had a way to elect board members, right?
Well, it had a methodology to amend certain parts of the covenants. But what the bank did was they took that and ran roughshod over the idea that you had to have homeowner control after the period of declarant control expired. Now, there's an issue in the case regarding the expiration of declarant control. And it's our position, first of all, that the period of declarant control indeed did expire because of the various mechanisms by which the declaration sets forth that to occur. And also, frankly, the Court of Appeals below that this court took transfer from found that the bank wouldn't be appropriate declarant anyway under the definition of declarant. More importantly, the bank, when it stocked this board with its executives, elected those board members twice. So they recognized that they had to elect the board members. Now that these members, we recognize that these board members had to be elected, you then look back at the restrictions and the covenants that says, well, are there qualifications that elected board members have to have? And yes, there are two important parts of that. In the original Declaration of Covenants and Restrictions said that they had to be residents. In other words, they had to live in the neighborhood. And second, they had to be people other than the declarant. Now, whether the bank is the appropriate declarant or not under the Court of Appeals analysis or not, we'll leave that aside. But we know that the bank executives were not residents. They were not qualified. So when this was pointed out to the bank, what they did was, we have, and I think it's important to note, they had a contractual obligation to McKelvey Homes, the other respondent in this case, because of an option agreement they entered into prior to all of this occurring, where they said, you know what, we're going to make sure that your home, your plans either get approved or we'll talk to you about how we can get those approved. So they had put themselves in a bit of a contractual fix, a bind, if you will, of either breaching obligations that were owed under the declaration or breaching contractual obligations owed to McKelvey. So they went ahead and elected their own board members, and then when they realized they couldn't do that without being consistent with the covenants, went ahead and purported to amend the restrictions to take away the idea that the declarant or that these board members had to be somebody other than the declarant had to be residents.
And did they have authority to change the requirements like that? But you're saying they exercised it in bad faith, or are you also saying they had no authority, even if they acted in good faith?
Your Honor, I don't think they had authority to do that, and I do think it was important the way they did it. I think, first of all, it was also an additional restriction. You strip away that important right of self-governance that the neighborhood had. You've taken away and put in a tremendous burden on the homeowners. But also, they've created a bit of a logical inconsistency because you have this idea of a period of declarant control expiring. And what they're saying is, you know what? Even though the period of declarant control has expired, we're going to go ahead and allow the declarant to still control the subdivision by virtue of this amendment. So it was a total sham in the way it worked out.
Now, the trial court found that the banks acted reasonably and in good faith, and that's a finding of fact. So under a standard review, how can we ignore that?
Well, Your Honor, under the standard of review, you need to look at whether the court properly applied the law. I mean, I understand the standard of review issue. First of all, we have a misapplication of the law because the court believed, as you'll see in the findings of fact and conclusions of law, that it had to defer to the board and the decision that it made. But we were questioning, the whole idea of this case is questioning the reasonableness that the board made. As a result, the court had to go back, step back, and look at what the court did, other than simply defer to what the board did. And in the conclusions of law, the trial court states that it deferred. So I think you have a misapplication of law. And also, I believe that there's no substantial evidence that supports that decision, and it's against the weight of the evidence. So under the standard review, I believe that this court can reverse the trial court on that point.
Who was the fiduciary duty of the bank owed to? Was it their argument is that the subdivision was failing unless they found someone to build the additional homes on the additional lots. And so that was their obligation, and not just to the five current owners. And the five current owners say, we're the only residents, we're the one who you owed it to. How do we deal with those competing views?
Well, Your Honor, they could have spoken to my clients about what my clients wanted to have happen at the subdivision if they had fiduciary obligations. First of all, they had fiduciary obligations as a result of their being on the board. They could have avoided that by not being on the board. In other words,
my question is, your argument presumed that their only fiduciary obligation was to the five residents. And I'm asking, is that true, or was it to the owners of all the lots?
They were the owners of the
lots. That's what's best, because the bank, they said, owned the other lots.
Your Honor, at that time, the bank owned all of the other lots.
Okay. So their obligation was to all the owners,
as members of the board, they had fiduciary obligations to all of the owners.
And I don't know the answer to this, but what you're saying, there's no evidence to support it. Did the bank present evidence that it was best for the subdivision as a whole to have McCulley come in and build these, or have some developer come in?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that there was some testimony from one of the board executives who was involved in the case, who said that he thought it was in the best interest of the subdivision to be built by McKelvey. Now, there's also evidence that they had received inquiry from custom home builders who had some interest at that time in building some custom homes, but that was not explored.
And your argument is they had a vested interest in having McKelvey get it because of their separate contractual agreement, and that's what they looked at, and not the overall benefit.
Your Honor, the evidence is clear, and I believe that the bank's executive even admitted this at trial. The bank was in it on the short run. They had foreclosed on these lots. They wanted to dispose of their interest and maximize their return on the collateral that they had been secured and get rid of these lots, right? They wanted to do that. So they had to do that, and to accomplish that, they entered into this option agreement with McKelvey, which they thought would be the most expeditious way for the bank to go ahead and to make its financial recovery, if you will. And in doing that, they did not look at my client's interest. They did not ask my clients, what do you want us to do? They did not look at the idea of other custom home builders in here. But, Your Honor, they could have avoided any of those fiduciary obligations by remaining off the board. There's another option that the bank could have taken here. When the bank realized that it had to elect the directors to the homeowners association. Let's assume for the moment that that homeowners association they established was correct and had the authority to act, which we question. They could have gone ahead and had elections. My clients, some of them could have been elected to that board. The plans from McKelvey could have been presented to that board of correctly and properly elected homeowners on that board. And there could have been an approval process of those McKelvey plans. There then could have been a discussion regarding those plans with the members of that properly constituted board. And there could have been some way to get through this. Or if not, arguably, the bank or McKelvey may have had an action against the properly constituted board for failure to exercise its obligations correctly.
Now, the new board members have an obligation to the minority interests, the resident owners, to hear their viewpoints or to not be take actions that are detrimental to the minority interests on the other resident owners of the other properties.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, as members of that board, they owed an obligation, an admitted obligation, to the homeowners, the five homeowners, who I assume that that's what you're referring to by
right.
The minority owners. Absolutely.
And also, was there any evidence of the diminution of value of the $1.7 million houses when the $900,000 houses were built?
Your Honor, there was some evidence of diminution of value, but the value issue is really not part of the case at this point. The issue is really what the aesthetics and what is it, do the characteristics of the homes, do they look alike? So in other words, are they harmonious and do they meet that?
What was the zone? Could they build row houses? Like, I'm from Philadelphia, and we have row houses everywhere.
I went to law school in Philadelphia, yes, I know. Yeah.
So could they build row houses there to sell it, you know, to get rid of the property? What were the limitations? Were there zoning requirements, or how far low could they go from 900,000? Could they go to 50,000 or 100,000 and build, you know, an apartment development there?
So, Your Honor, I don't want to come off as being flippant with the court, but I don't know what that board would have approved. And frankly, had McKelvey wanted to build those, that bank's stock board may have gone ahead and approved something that was a row house. Although, once again, you go down the spectrum where some things become very clear that it's not going to comply with the requirements. And I think that if you look at those pictures that I pointed out, particularly the picture of the house on Lot 13 and the picture of it's in construction on page A76, you'll see that it doesn't comply, as well as the architectural. We had an architectural expert come in, Mr. Bolanzina, who explained why there was a difference between my clients, the five homeowners, five houses, and the house that was constructed on Lot 13, both in terms of appearance, architectural style, materials that were being used, things like that.
Are there ongoing carrying charges? For example, I live in a condo. If the apartments aren't sold, someone's got to pick up the condo fees, the yellow, you know, but yet this is like land. It's not like, are there ongoing assessments or charges they have every month that the residents would pay or that the bank would have to pay?
Yes, Your Honor, there is an issue in the case. It's a modest issue in the case regarding some assessments that were passed through to my clients, and there is a provision for our assessments being passed through under the Declaration of Covenants and Restrictions for upkeep of common ground and things like that.
Thank you. You have some time on rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the Court.
You may proceed.
I'd like to start, Your Honor, with the language that appears in italics. It's the preamble to Article 3 of the Declaration. It's at page 35 in the legal file. The success of the community is dependent upon the support and participation of every owner in its governance and administration. This declaration establishes the association as the mechanism by which each owner is able to provide that support and participation. It says each owner, so that every owner of every lot, and my client Jefferson Bank is owner of 13 lots, is entitled to its vote on every issue for each lot, and it's entitled to participate in the affairs of the subdivision. There are a few things that were noticeably absent from counsel's argument. First is any discussion of the standard of review. As Chief Justice Russell pointed out, This case comes to this court with the benefit of findings by the trial court that the bank officers who were involved here, who were trying to manage this difficult situation from day one, acted in good faith and reasonably approved the plans that were submitted to them for approval. That is a finding of fact. It is made by a trial judge who heard Mr. Dulley, president of the bank, also one of the trustees of the subdivision by virtue of the events that we've talked about in the briefs, come before her. And Mr. Dulley testified that he recognized that he wore two hats. He had duties to his bank, of course, but he recognized also that he had a fiduciary duty as a board member to all of the residents of the subdivision, and that he believed that he reasonably discharged that by going out and securing independent architectural advice as to whether the plans that McKelvey proposed actually complied with the declaration, and by securing advice as to value. I'm delighted to hear that value is not in the case anymore, because earlier in its stages, we repeatedly heard about how the plaintiffs had spent money on these wonderful homes that the plaintiffs had, and nobody's denying that the plaintiffs built some really spectacular homes with the money that they put into it. But the argument is whether those homes would somehow be diminished in value by what McKelvey was proposing. Also wonderful homes, and I'm delighted to hear Mr. Ludlow concede that issue now, so that it's not an issue, and it's not, because the evidence was clear. Even their own appraiser said as much.
Can you address the argument that the bank was motivated to have to keep its contract with McKelvey as opposed to looking at what was best for the subdivision as a whole? And then its only option was not McKelvey. There were others.
Right, I understand. And there's another point about that contract that I was pleased to hear something from for plaintiff's counsel this morning. In their brief, they state that the contract that the bank had with McKelvey required the bank's directors to approve the homes. Didn't say that. What it said is simply that we were required to take efforts to see that the designs were approved, or if they weren't approved, that reasons were given for the disapproval so that they could be brought into compliance with the declaration, so that the plans could be approved, the homes could be built, and Mr. Brennan from McKelvey get on with the very important task of building houses. So this subdivision, which has had six houses in it now, or five houses in it for some number of years, can actually be completed. And that's what was attempting to be accomplished.
And was there evidence you're saying that you only considered McKelvey and that was what was in bad
faith?
No, because
no,
of
to the contrary. Mr. Dulley talked about the thought process that he went through in trying to determine the best way to do this. He thought it would not be helpful to bring in a series of custom builders to try and build homes who would know what they might look like. Remember, this is at the height of the difficulties of the housing and banking crisis that resulted in this 2008-2010 period. And as Mr. Dulley testified, he wanted to be careful about who he picked, because this subdivision had been through one foreclosure and didn't want to have another one. So he picked a 113 or 114-year-old builder with a reputation in St. Louis for building high-quality homes. And he selected McKelvey as the builder to do that. And they entered a contract, which gave some financial interest to the bank to see that the homes were built out, but the bank would have that interest anyway because it wanted to sell its lots. So Mr. Dulley recognized that there were these competing interests.
Now, in dealing with the difficult issues, because the bank is trying to do the best they can at putting good homes in, but also getting out of this deal where they foreclosed on it and they want to get in the business of making money. However, in the original declaration, the bank was involved in working with the developer, original developer, and financed it, and knew the original declaration and the representation that in the original declaration that the board was made up of actual residents. And so it was basically some concession to the idea that the residents, even though the bank's involved and whatever could happen and may happen, the residents were supposed to be the ones in the board who would run the subdivision.
There are two issues in there, and they're both very important issues to this case. The first issue is, did the bank sign on to the plaintiff's concept that all the houses in the subdivision had to be this rather unusual for St. Louis County design by putting its signature on the declaration? And the answer is the bank never did that, because there is nothing in the declaration that requires that the homes be stucco and brick. There's nothing in the declaration that requires that they be of the particular prairie style that Mr. Ledlove says is so important. And in fact, there are style differences among the homes. So what the bank signed off on was a declaration that said there would be a board which would consider aesthetics and quality and uniform quality in determining whether to approve new designs. So the homeowners did not take the step of making sure that the bank had signed into this concept of building these homes, which were obviously somewhat difficult to sell in St. Louis County. The second part of
But they knew that they had to be residents.
Yeah, the idea of being residents, Josh, thank you for reminding me. And the answer is that in the original declaration, residents would not serve on the board until more than two-thirds of would control the board until more than two-thirds of the lots had been sold to residents. So that at 25%, the homeowners would have a seat on the board. And from the beginning, when the bank exercised its right as owner to determine, to have a voice in the composition of the board offered a seat to the residents. Initially, they declined it. Initially, Mr. Lamley, one of the plaintiffs here, also served on the board. So it was a 2-to-1 board representing the proportion of the homeowners as they were within the subdivision. They had one seat out of 3. They had 5 lots out of 18. It made sense. And unfortunately, it became a contentious situation. It did not work as well as it ought to have worked from all sides, I think, in getting this done. But the bank officers were using due diligence and their reasonable efforts to do what they had to do.
And many of these actions that the bank took were after the lawsuit was filed by the plaintiffs.
Changing
the residency. Yeah. So where is the good faith there?
Well, it is, Your Honor, because the lawsuit, if anything, is a spur to good faith. Let's talk about good faith for a minute.
I'm thinking about the timing.
Right. Let's talk about the timing. Another thing omitted from Mr. Plaintiff's counsel's discussion was any reference to the original homeowners, the homeowners association that the plaintiffs organized. About the first thing that the bank knew about that homeowners association is it had been expelled from it. Bank acquires by foreclosure, I think, in March of 2010. Bank is a defendant in a lawsuit by May of 2010. There's a conflict in the testimony about who should have been talking to whom. I don't think that's all that important. So then the lawsuit starts. And from that point on, the bank is very much aware that its actions are being watched and questioned and is working very hard to make sure that it takes those steps that are necessary to comply with the obligations that it owes. And there is a factual dispute about whether the bank's actions were taken in good faith. After Mr. Dully testified before Judge Reno, plaintiff's counsel had every opportunity to cross-examine him and took full opportunity of that in a thorough and vigorous cross-examination, which you can see in the record. Mr. Dully testified both at the preliminary injunction hearing and at the permanent injunction hearing. And after hearing all that, the trial judge concluded that Mr. Dully and Mr. Ross, acting for the board, had in fact acted in good faith. And that is a factual finding, which is supported with the record. There's no error of law that infects it. So under the Murphy versus Karen standard, that factual finding comes to this court with some expectation that it should be affirmed, because it is a correct finding. And for that reason, that finding should be affirmed. Talk for a minute about this good faith and fair dealing argument, which is important to the Court of Appeals. And that relates to the amendment of the declaration by which bank officers were permitted to serve. And the Court of Appeals, 2-1, accepted the plaintiff's argument, although the dissenting judge did not, that there had in fact been a violation of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing in that amendment. The theory of that is that there was somehow an expectation on the plaintiff's part that early on the subdivision would be controlled entirely by residents, the subject I was talking about earlier, so that it was somehow an unreasonable thwarting of their expectations to do that. Now, the plaintiffs like to talk about the Rocky Ridge case, which I think we have pretty well distinguished in the brief. That was a sham case. That was a case where the developer lost from the tribal court because he concocted fraudulent lots to try and take control of the subdivision. That's not our case. There was no fraud here. There was no deception on the part of the bank. Everything the bank did was open and above board. Necessarily, there was litigation pending. There were records made of every hearing. A lot of those transcripts are in the record. So that there was no subterfuge or evasion. The trial court so found. That's a finding of fact. That is entitled to deference on appeal.
I think opposing counsel's argument is that taking action openly, as you did, to remove the control that the existing residents had is in itself bad faith because it can't be in their interest. It's in the board's interest. That's why the board's officers were put in as directors. Can
and
you address that?
That is a fact question. And that is a fact question because it is quite right that one can have a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing in a circumstance where there has been no subterfuge, no evasion done openly, which is the branch of the argument that the plaintiffs are relying here and that the Court of Appeals majority relied on. But what they overlook is that, A, the plaintiffs never offered proof that they had an expectation that before they owned two-thirds of the lots, they'd be able to control the subdivision. As we say in our briefs, nobody's expectations got fulfilled here. The bank expected it was going to get paid back. It didn't. It had to help deal with a very difficult situation that neither the developer, the homeowners, nor the bank envisioned at the time, and it took steps to amend the declaration to give itself representation on the board because the success of the community is dependent upon the support and participation of every owner, including the bank.
What type of foreclosure proceedings were involved when the bank took their properties?
I've seen the deed of foreclosure, Judge, and I assume it's a non-judicial foreclosure, but I haven't found the answer myself to that question.
Do you still maintain that I think it was still the declarant the question of whether there'd been a transfer of ownership, and opposing counsel says that even if this court agreed that the first transfer was to a related entity, that once bankruptcy occurred, once you foreclosed, there clearly had been a transfer of ownership, so that opportunity had ended for the declarant to set up who was on the board.
I'm not so sure that's the case. First, I'm not sure that that's the controlling issue here because the amendment of the declaration.
So you would depend on whether or not the election.
But alternatively, I do not believe that the simple events that took place actually constituted a loss of declarant control. End of the period of declarant control.
And how could it not be when you foreclosed so that it was no longer owned by the developer? Wasn't that a requirement?
Because the bank itself took an assignment of all the developer's rights as developer.
But that was a...
In fact, the bank... Go ahead, Your Honor. I didn't mean to interrupt.
And is that relevant to the end of declarant control?
I think it should be in terms of what was going on in this...
Well, what does it say in the agreement, I mean, on that issue?
It has detailed language of the period of declarant control, which I can find.
Doesn't it say change of ownership? Doesn't say change of ownership without assignment, does it?
It does. You're quite right. It does refer to change of ownership. But nonetheless, what was happening on the ground was that the bank was acting as the declarant and was maintaining the subdivision, was paying all the costs. Nobody else had stepped up in terms of taking control of and paying for the management of the subdivision, and the bank was doing it. So the bank always argued and continues to argue that it is the declarant. But the important point, as I made before, Your Honor, is that once that declaration gets amended to eliminate the residency requirement, then any requirement that directors be residents is eliminated. And that.
And again, because the key point to me is whether there was authority to do that. A second issue is whether there was good faith in doing that. But the first issue is whether there was authority. And what are the two positions on that?
Your Honor, the declaration states that it may be amended, if I may answer your question.
Please.
The declaration states that it may be amended by vote of two-thirds of the lots, and two-thirds of the lot voted for the amendment. So that is the authority to do it. It was done in good faith, as the trial court found. It did not impose any new restrictions on the plaintiffs' homes. It did not impose any new financial obligations on the plaintiffs. So it doesn't run afoul of that rule which says that there are certain amendments that require unanimous consent. This was the type of amendment that are approved by a number of the decisions we've cited, which state that these types of provisions that permit amendment by a supermajority vote are valid.
Thank you.
This vote was valid. The bank acted reasonably in good faith on behalf of the residents of all of this subdivision, and the judgment of the trial court sustaining the bank's actions and McKelvey's should be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I would like to address a couple of points that counsel has made in his argument. First of all is what the bank signed on for. The bank signed on for this Declaration of Restrictions and Covenants that precisely in Article 10 required that the purpose was to maintain the uniform quality and aesthetics of the exterior architectural design for the best interest of the community as a whole, and that they should consider that the houses should be harmonious in exterior appearance with the existing improvements in the subdivision, including architectural design, height, grade, topography, drainage, things like that. That's what the bank signed on for. With the other things, the other argument, one of the arguments that council made was that, you know, you got to look at the time period. This was, you know, when the bank foreclosed, this was at the height of the problems in the economy, and so the bank was in a world of hurt. Well, that's not where you should just focus. You need to focus on the entire spectrum. Where were things when the bank started this? Where were things when the bank made the loan and when it subrogated its interest to the declaration? Well, things were pretty good. And had the bank had concerns, the bank could have gone to the cleric before it subrogated its interest and said, you know what, I need to have some way to get out of this or control the subdivision if I have to have a foreclosure. So the bank could have been more careful in its approach at the outset before it subrogated its interest and said, I have to be able to have control of that subdivision properly if there is indeed a foreclosure. The bank did not do that, so what it signed on for, it signed on for. Now let's talk about one of the other arguments the council made, and that is that the bank, after it took control of the homeowners association, exercised its duties and due diligence in good faith. Well, let's talk about some of the problems with that and what they did. First of all, there's the option agreement. They have a clear conflict of interest with regard to that option agreement. They know that they're beholden to McKelvey Homes on approving their plans or working with them to make sure they get approved. There's no, hey, I can deny your plans. There's nothing in the option agreement that says that. They also have a profit interest. They're sharing profits with McKelvey. Of course they have an interest that's different than my clients. So we have that issue to start and frame things. First of all, this idea that they used independent experts that came in, that's cited in their briefs, they used their trial experts as their independent experts. They identified them later in the process. Third, this purported review on other subdivisions that Mr. Dolley allegedly drove through and saw them and said, hey, it looks nice, those houses all don't look alike and everything's fine. Well, you know, that's interesting that they make that argument, but that was never something, evidence that was presented before any of the board meetings of the Homeowners Association. This was made up, first of all, for a trial, and secondly, it's irrelevant because we don't know what, if any, restrictions existed in those subdivisions that Mr. Dolley drove through. The third is, the grading plan was changed. I mean, Mr. Dolley went to the city of De Pere and got the grading plan changed before this all happened. And in doing so, he told the city of De Pere, hey, we're in the middle, they're in the middle of litigation, and he tells the city of De Pere, the litigation's not an issue, it's done. And of course it wasn't. And he gets the grading plan changed, and he gets the grading plan changed so that it meets McKelvey's footprint for these plans. So how could there be good faith in the actions of that bank executive who was on the board in taking those actions? And then we have the amendment to the declaration. Would you strip the homeowners of their right to self-governance? I don't know how that could be anything but bad faith. And then finally, we have the conduct that occurred at the Homeowners Association meetings themselves. Those meetings were basically run by the banks.
What was the vote for changing the bylaws was, I guess, 13-5?
That would have been correct, Your Honor. Yeah, because the bank owned 13 lots at the time.
So they needed 2/3 and just barely got the one more lot had been sold, that they wouldn't have to, they'd have exactly their 2/3.
Right, that's correct, Your Honor. But let's talk about the conduct at those homeowners.
You're out of time, counsel.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Make a wrap-up statement?
No, Your Honor, I think the evidence is clear that these homes do not comply with the declarations. I think the way the bank has run the board and their conduct here requires a finding of lack of good faith, and that the trial court's decision should be overturned. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken and submitted.